Welcome to the Awakened Parent Project, Conscious Conversations, Empowered Parenting, with me, Susan Dolce. It's time to open our hearts and our minds to what it means to be a parent, exploring and expanding the ways we communicate, validate, and show up daily for our kids. With a parent-centric focus, you learn to become more present, a better active listener, more reflective, more engaged, and mutually empowered. Parenting isn't about perfection. It's about presence, honesty, self-compassion, unconditional love, and conscious communication. The Awakened Parent Project starts now. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Awakened Parent Project. I'm your host. I'm Susan Dolce. I'm a certified parent coach with the Jai Institute for Parenting, and it's my hope that you will find this a safe space to journey on a path of both practical and spiritual self-exploration. From the time my first daughter was born in 1994, I've been driven by a vision where children are nurtured both physically and spiritually by adults who are present, grounded, and empowered. I believe that conscious communication, self-exploration, and self-forgiveness are the tools that enable parents to foster deep, lasting connections with their children. Parenting isn't about perfection. It's about presence, honesty, self-compassion, unconditional love, and conscious communication. And today we are diving into a very sensitive yet important topic of adolescent substance abuse, which continues to be a crisis confronting many families. So today I'm chatting with an expert in this field, Richard Capirola. Richard has been a mental health and substance abuse counselor for over two decades. He recently retired from the Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas, where for over a decade, he treated adolescent and adults diagnosed with substance abuse issues. He's the author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse, which you can get on Amazon, and you can also get it through his website, helptheaddictedchild.com. Welcome, Richard. It's so good to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me today to spend some time talking about, as you noted, this very important topic of adolescent substance abuse and how it affects so many families, and parents and grandparents and just lots of people affected by this.
Well, I'd imagine, transparency. I mean, I don't look like I'm not a young mom. I no longer have teenagers. I have all adult children, but I can't imagine whether it's adult, but more specifically, if it's a child, how isolated families feel when they find out their child has a substance abuse issue, because I'm sure there's a lot of shock and shame and fear and disbelief. And what I'm like I said, I've got adult children. I can't even imagine what drugs and substances. I mean, there seems to be new ones all the time you hear about in the news. And so with that in mind, what drugs are teens using today that maybe we haven't heard about, and especially if you aren't up on, you know, not taking the time to be up on it. And your book is a treasure trove. I believe every parent should have this book as a resource just for the way you list all of the different substances that can be abused.
Well, thank you so much. And you're absolutely right that parents are often caught off guard and surprised when they learn that their child has been using a substance like marijuana or even drinking alcohol. So many times I would sit across from a parent and I would go through their child's history of using substances, and I would give them a diagnosis of a substance use disorder. And they would look across at me and they would say, I had no idea this was going on. Mm-hmm. Or if they did suspect their child was using a substance, they might say, I sort of thought something was going on, but I didn't know it was this bad. And these are good parents. These are very good parents doing the best job that they can. They miss the warning signs because nobody told them what to look for. And as a result, they often walk away, you know, feeling very angry sometimes, feeling as if they let their family down, feeling very very much as if they're not a good parent, and going through all of these emotions, when in reality, they missed the warning signs because no one told them what to look for. So they were caught off guard. And some parents are under the impression that substance abuse happens to other children. It doesn't happen in their family. It doesn't happen with their children. And then they're surprised when they learn that it does. You ask about what substances teenagers are using. And for a long time, it's been fairly consistent. Teenagers are attracted to alcohol and marijuana as their primary sources of substance. There is some exposure to the more hardcore, so to speak, drugs like marijuana, amphetamines, some over-the-counter and prescription drugs. But by and large, teenagers are still attracted to using marijuana and alcohol. Prior to the pandemic, we had seen an alarming increase in teenagers who were turning to vaping substances like marijuana and nicotine. Vaping is a term that we use to describe someone who takes a substance like nicotine or marijuana, uses a vaping instrument that turns it into a vapor, and then they inhale it. Well, prior to the pandemic, for about 3 years, there had been an alarming increase in the number of teenagers that were turning to vaping. Now, the pandemic had an interesting effect on teenage substance use. It actually brought down the percentage of teenagers who were using substances. For example, the percentage of high school seniors that were drinking alcohol during the pandemic dropped from 55% to 47%. The percentage of high school seniors that were smoking marijuana dropped from 35% down to 31%. And even among adolescents who were vaping, we saw a decline during the pandemic years. Now, about a year from now, we'll know, now that kids are back into the traditional classroom setting, if the decline is maintained or if we see a spike back increase in substance use among teenagers.
Do you think that was fueled by lack of accessibility? Or that maybe they're just maybe because they weren't in the classroom, there was less anxiety? I remember in your book, you said a lot of the times kids will say that they smoke weed because it makes them feel less anxious.
Yes.
And that kind of blew me away, because I always kind of thought of it as a sort of a recreational, but sort of a peer based recreational activity, not because they actually made the connection that smoking weed also lowers their anxiety. So I'm curious about, you know, what the change is with the pandemic.
I think the decline is attributed primarily to the fact that during the year, kids were removed from their social environment. They were removed from their extracurricular activities, and they were pretty much isolated at home doing online learning, didn't have as much exposure to peers, didn't have as much time away from home. And I think that was a big factor that caused the decline in substance use that we saw. Now, as kids are back into the regular school system, engaging with their peers and getting involved in social and athletic activities, it'll be interesting for us to see if there's a rebound, if we see an increase in substance use during this academic year. But although we saw a decline in substance abuse during the pandemic year, we saw an increase in mental health issues. And I think we're just scratching the surface for both adults and adolescents on what the pandemic caused among mental health issues. Teenagers reported higher levels of anxiety, higher levels of feeling anger, feeling depressed, feeling very anxious. And I think a lot of that was due to the pandemic. But quite honestly, for 10 years prior to the pandemic, we'd already seen an alarming trend in terms of mental health needs for adolescents. The pandemic, I think, just sort of added fuel to what we were already seeing.
Yeah, I really pray for the generations that are coming up that they get the help that they need, especially through the school systems, as they can identify that. Yes, I have a question about the vaping, the vaping, because when my youngest was in high school, a few of her friends were, they were addicted to the nicotine in vaping. And I, you know, they had, and the ways they sought out people for them to get the, I guess it comes in a pod, right? It's like a little, little pod. I've always been curious how you get marijuana in a pod, like where, is there pod dealers? Like, I don't know about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I understand the traditional methods of, you know, regular marijuana, but I've always been curious about how those are dispersed.
Well, they're made available, manufactured, you know, in many of the same ways that nicotine is. Kids have access to it. They can buy it. They can get it online. They can get it from their friends. I think the smoking of marijuana through a joint, I think, is still the very popular way of kids smoking marijuana. Mm-hmm. Nicotine is a little bit different in that, if you talk to kids, they will tell you, well, vaping is safer than smoking cigarettes. And in a way, they're right. And adolescent smoking of cigarettes is at an all-time low. But I think what's happened is teenagers have switched from smoking cigarettes and cigars to vaping nicotine because they do have the impression that it's either easier to conceal or it's less dangerous, less harmful, because it doesn't contain all of the carcinogens that we find in tobacco. But the problem is that, there's two problems. One problem is that they get higher concentrations of nicotine than they might get from smoking cigarettes. So they're really getting more nicotine. And the second is, regardless of whether it's marijuana or whether it's nicotine or it's any other illicit drug, we need to remember that the teenage brain is in the process of maturing and developing. Our brains don't become fully developed until around age 24 or 25.
Yeah, so try to tell that to a 26-year-old. Yes. Yeah, absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
it runs the risk of doing some damage to that developing brain, especially for the young teenagers, the ones who are in adolescent years. You may not notice those changes. You may not see them, but I have seen them in the psychological and the neuropsychological reports that come back from teenagers that have been smoking a lot of marijuana. And these were kids whose IQs were very high. They were above average or superior. But what I noticed was that when these kids were smoking marijuana, oftentimes multiple times a day, the test came back and it showed that the processing speed of their brain was below average. Their short-term memory was often impaired, and their motivation was substantially impaired as well. So you might not notice some of these subtle changes going on in the brain, but chances are that that the drug might be producing some changes in key areas that child will need either later in school or later in life.
Yes, indeed. And these are all things I feel for parents that, like when we started the show, that find themselves in these situations. I can't imagine how scary it is. We're gonna take a quick break, and we come back. I want to talk about what the difference is between teen addiction and adult addiction.
Okay.
Today, I have Richard Capriola. He's the author of The Addicted Child, and we'll be right back.
Have you heard about shifting the collective vibration and consciousness on the planet? Join me, Kimberly Barrett, on the Sharing Love and Light show every first and third Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at transformationtalkradio.com to explore the depth of vibration and consciousness on our planet and learn how you can shine your love and light. To learn more, visit sharingloveandlightshow.com.
Champion your life with me, Leanne Champion, first and third Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. That new gym membership might help you get fit, but what about emotional fitness? jump into the rushing waters of personal growth. Don't waste another minute feeling unfulfilled. Visit championyourlife.com and let's do this together.
Optimize your breast cancer screening without any radiation or pain. Effective, sensitive, and widely used thermal imaging in Europe is now available to you here in the U.S. Using state-of-the-art FDA-approved camera, Eastside's first and only breast thermography clinic is now open in Bellevue. Safe, sensitive, low cost, no referrals needed. Contact Holistic Medical Center at 425-451-0404 or on the web, drdarvish.com.
TransformationTalkRadio.com. Let the journey begin.
Welcome back, everybody. Today, I'm talking with Richard Capriola. He is the author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. Richard, where can people find you, especially when they need, everybody needs your book. Like I said, everybody needs to get it. Where can people find you?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. The book's website is, I think you mentioned earlier, is helptheaddictedchild.com, helptheaddictedchild.com. I would encourage everyone to visit that website. There are some articles on there. I have an article on how the pandemic affected teenage substance use. There's another article on mental health, and I have listed 10 easy, quick questions that you can ask your teenager to check in from time to time on their mental health. There's also book reviews, book endorsements, and a link that will take you to Amazon where you can order a copy of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. It's available as a paperback or Kindle. I kept it to about 100 pages because I know parents are busy. They don't have time to read volumes of information. And there's also a link where if you're interested, you can send me a comment or you can ask me a question and it'll come directly to me. So the easiest way to get there is through the book's website, helptheaddictedchild.com.
And again, it lists how many chapters. You've got several chapters dedicated to just the different types of substances.
Yes.
And like even inhalants, like these are the things and like ecstasy and Molly and all of those drugs that are, again, things that are sort of under my radar as a parent that are definitely important to know about.
Exactly. And that's why I included those brief chapters. Parents are aware of things like alcohol and marijuana and nicotine. They might not be aware of some of these other drugs that are out there on the street, like inhalants and like some of the other drugs that are out there. So I wanted to give parents a very brief synopsis of what those drugs are that they should at least have a little bit of information on and be aware of.
I remember there was a time, and maybe this is not a thing anymore, where kids were using like the whipped cream, what do you call it? Like the canisters for reusable whipped cream to inhale. And there was a time I had one of those, you know, whipped cream things and they started selling them behind the counter. I was like, why are they behind the counter now? I had like no clue that was actually being used as an inhalant.
Yeah, that falls in the category, as you just mentioned, of inhalants. They are many times common household products that we have around the home. They might be paint thinners. They might be paint. They might be glue. They all have in common that they have this odor, so to speak, this inhalant that kids will inhale. What inhalants have in common, though, is that they produce a very rapid but short-lived high. And because it is so rapid and because it is so short-lived, people will tend to use it repeatedly over and over and over again because it doesn't last very long. And that can be even more damaging to the developing brain. And we tend to see this in adolescents and pre-adolescents that are very young, before they move on to things like alcohol and marijuana. So they might be pre-teenagers, they might be early age teenagers, teenagers. And as I say, the access to these inhalants is so easy because many of us have around our home these household products that have this inhalant characteristic to them. So as a parent, you need to sort of take inventory and see if you have any of those around the house and then secure them.
Mm-hmm. So before the break, I mentioned that I'd like for you to explain what the difference is between teen addiction and adult addiction.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there are two differences. The first we talked a little bit about, and that's brain development. After around age 24 or 25, our brains are fully matured. So one of the difference between adolescent addiction and adult addiction is brain development, the difference between the adolescent brain and the adult brain. The second difference is in consequences. Adults who are addicted to a substance have often faced catastrophic consequences. They might have lost a job. They might have lost a marriage. They might have been incarcerated. These are catastrophic consequences that adults, unfortunately, who are addicted oftentimes face. Adolescents, on the other hand, have very few, if any, catastrophic consequences. Their big consequence usually is their parents coming down on them or restricting them or yelling at them. But they haven't faced the kind of catastrophic consequences that an adult addict has faced, unfortunately. Losing a job, losing a marriage, alienating their family, or being incarcerated. So adolescent consequences are significantly different than adult consequences when it comes to addiction.
When, again, my youngest daughter was in high school, several of her close friends suffered from addiction. And at least one, I know for sure, participated in one of the rehab camps, over the summer, where you kind of like a wilderness camp. Do you have any opinion on whether these programs work? Or, I mean, I guess it depends on the willingness of the child to want to change the behavior.
Well, the wilderness camps provide a very, I think, beneficial service to a certain population of teenagers that are very resistant to treatment. When I was at Menninger Clinic, we often would refer a child to a wilderness program or to a longer-term treatment program because the issues that they were facing, either mental health and substance abuse, were so severe that they needed a longer-term treatment. A wilderness program does a very good job with getting children motivated for treatment, because many of the children who go to a wilderness program go there reluctantly, are very resistant to treatment. And the wilderness program serves a valuable service to families in that they can play a very important role in getting that child more motivated for treatment. And the child moves on to treatment and hopefully does very well.
So we were talking about, you did mention some of the reasons why teens use substances. But you mentioned in the book, anxiety, trauma from bullying, things like that. It's quite often more than just social or peer pressure.
It is. There are a lot of reasons why teenagers are attracted to drugs. Some of it is peer pressure. Some of it is just being involved with other kids that are using substances, and they get tempted to go along with their friends. But for some kids, not all kids, but for some kids, there may be an underlying psychological reason as to why that child is using a substance. The example I would give you is that many of the teenagers that I worked with when I was at Menninger Clinic who were using marijuana, when I asked them to help me understand why they were smoking so much marijuana, the number one answer that came back was, it helps me with my anxiety. So for some kids, not all kids, but for some kids, there may be an underlying reason why they're using that substance. Maybe it's anxiety. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's some type of trauma. Maybe it's being bullied at school that the parents knew nothing about. Maybe it's an emerging personality disorder. There are all kinds of underlying reasons why a child might be using a substance to medicate what I usually refer to as an intolerable thought, feeling, or memory. Mm-hmm. Kids are no different than adults. If we have an intolerable thought, or feeling, or memory, we're not built to sit with that. We want to do something about it. We want to get rid of it. And usually the getting rid part, the solution can be found in a substance. So the message to parents is, if you have a child that you suspect is using a substance, whether it's alcohol or drugs, you want to get a comprehensive assessment, like I outline in my book, so that you can rule in or rule out whether or not your child is facing any of these other issues other than just the substances. Because if that's the case, you need to provide treatment for both the substance use and the underlying treatment. It's not going to do very good just to treat the marijuana use if I don't help that child with their anxiety. So it's very important that that we diagnose it if it's there, and that the treatment plan include both substance abuse treatment and treatment for the underlying psychological issue if it's there.
I feel like that, based on experience, personal experiences, that those two don't often come hand in hand. Mm-hmm. That there's usually, what I normally see is, punishment. Like, it's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you were using alcohol. I didn't know you had this friend group. Now you can't, and it's you're grounded. you can't participate in, your favorite activities or whatever, like that this is going to help the situation. And I just feel like this is, again, why, like, the services you provided at Menninger, and I'm sure, the way you can still help people now, is to understand that it's so much more than just the substance. It's not just drinking beers with your buddies. Like, it's there's so much more going on.
It may be. It may be that there are other issues going on. And I think parents often react out of fear. Mm-hmm. And when they discover their child is hanging around with friends drinking alcohol or hanging around with their friends smoking marijuana, we become very frightened as parents. And that's a normal reaction. But then we often want to do exactly as you say. We want to come down on the child. We want to punish them, so to speak. When what we should be doing is having a conversation with our child about what we're observing and how we're feeling about it. Don't attack the child. Don't threaten the child. Don't punish the child. You want to approach the discussion from an inquiring point of view. I'm seeing these behaviors, or I'm observing this. Can you help me understand why I'm seeing this? Now, that's a discussion that's likely to go one of two ways. The child's it's either going to blow up and the child's going to get angry and defensive, or you might go the other way and you learn some things. But regardless of how that discussion goes, if you're still concerned as a parent, you need to move to the next stage and get the assessments from the professionals done so that you can get a diagnosis if it's appropriate and get a treatment plan if it's needed.
Wonderful, wonderful advice. We're going to take another break. You're listening to the Awakened Parent Project, and we'll be back in a little bit.
If you've ever had a broken heart, you know how painful that can be and how long it can sometimes take to heal it. I'm Megan Edge, author of The Heart's Journey, Healing Hearts, Oracle Cards, and Guidebook, published with Balboa Press and Hay House. In The Heart's Journey, I share with you my own heartbreak and how I healed it through the beautiful hearts that found me in nature. From taking photographs of these hearts for myself, I've created this beautiful toolkit, which includes the guidebook, which has my story, how to work with oracle cards as a healing tool, and the story of each of these hearts as they cross my path. I've also created a beautiful journal. There's a pen, a bookmark, and of course, the 42 Healing Hearts Oracle Cards. You can order The Heart's Journey, Healing Hearts Oracle Cards, and Guidebook through my website, meganedge.ca, through Balboa Press, Amazon, and many other places online or your local shops. I look forward to hearing about your heart's healing.
Do you ever wonder why you are put here on this earth? What your soul is being called to do? What brings you the greatest satisfaction? Tune in to the Personal Wisdom Show with Nita Johnson on TransformationTalkRadio.com, where she will help you learn to really lean in and trust the wisdom and power within you, creating a success you never thought possible. If you want to grow this wisdom inside you and understand your life purpose, visit PersonalWisdomCoachingNow.com.
Courtney Cottrell is walking in her purpose, creating incredible tools to level up your life. Let's introduce you to the Unapologetically Favored Gift Shop, your one-stop shop for all Courtney's motivational books, custom created, inspirational gifts, and more. Products that remind you of your purpose on this planet, infused with the passion to uplift lives. Shop apparel, books, wall art, and more at shopfavored.net.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Dolce. You're listening to the Awakened Parent Project. And today I'm speaking with Richard Capriola. He's the author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. And this is a very, I mean, we could go on for 2 hours with to talk about this. But let's get to the heart of it. I, as a parent of child or a middle school child or a teenage child, what are the warning signs? What are the things I should be looking for that might be flying under the radar?
I think that's one of the benefits of why I wrote this book, was to give parents the warning signs on what to look for, at least as many as possible. So I've listed warning signs for alcohol, a child that might be using alcohol. I have warning signs for a child that might be smoking marijuana. I have warning signs for a child that might be developing an eating disorder or self-harming, because sometimes those will accompany a child using a substance. As a general rule, Susan, what I recommend to parents is pay attention to the changes that you see in your child. You know your child better than anyone. Don't assume that the changes that you're seeing is just normal adolescent acting out. It might very well be that, but it might also be an indication that there's something else going on underneath the surface that you need to pay attention to and be concerned about. Some examples would be a child whose grades are starting to decline, a child who gets into disciplinary problems at school, a child who used to enjoy participating in extracurricular activities no longer wants to participate or shows any interest in extracurricular activities, a child who used to introduce you to their friends. You knew who their friends were. You might have even known who their family members were. Now becomes very secretive of who their friends are, secretive about where they've been and who they've been with. And then, of course, if you have any, if you pick up on any strange odors coming from your child's room or any paraphernalia, those are obvious signs. Now, if some of these signs sort of come and go fairly quickly, it's probably not too concerning. But if they linger on over a period of time and then you start to see more and more of these warning signs, then I think it's a cause to be concerned and perhaps seek out getting some assessments done so that you as a parent get the information that you need and you deserve to make some decisions on what to do.
You mentioned the process disorders.
Yes.
And I have, you know, personal experience. Actually, I had an adult client who was in and out of eating disorder clinics, and she's based in the UK. And for probably from her young adult life on, would go through these treatment programs. And most of those programs are about healing your relationship to food, right? And so much, I mean, I suffered from anorexia as a teenager, and I understood, at least for me, it was about control. It was about wanting to have control over something, because I had felt like nothing in my life was in control. So I wonder about, like you said, they often do come hand in hand, and how many children might be, you know, I don't want to say misdiagnosed, but might be sent off to an eating disorder clinic when maybe they need to be in a more comprehensive program that's not just addressing the food? Or is it a step-by-step sort of thing?
Well, I think the best approach is to have a comprehensive approach to treatment so that we're not just focusing on one issue, say the marijuana, and we're ignoring a child's struggle with anxiety or depression or trauma. We get so focused on the drug use, especially parents, that we often either misdiagnose the underlying issue or we don't even diagnose it to begin with. Many children, certainly not all, but some children who are using the substance have an accompanying process disorder, what we call a process disorder. Process disorders are different than chemical disorders. The chemical disorders are the alcohol and the drugs. The process disorders are more behavioral in nature. The two examples that I have in my book are eating disorders and self-injury, because I saw those with teenagers. Not a high percentage, but there are some teenagers that are self-harming themselves, and there are some teenagers that are developing an eating disorder. I think that what I saw was the large number of those teenagers were girls, but I think there may be an underrepresentation of boys. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we may be missing a large number of young boys who are also developing eating disorders and self-injury. Right now, most of what I saw was young girls. But the important point is that these disorders are need to be treated along with whatever substance use the child is using. Now, what we often needed to be concerned about was when we brought them into the hospital, we could control their access to drugs, to marijuana. We could keep those away because they were confined mm-hmm. in a hospital. But what we noticed was that when they didn't have access to the marijuana as a coping skill, the other coping skill spiked up. So the mm-hmm. self-injury tended to try and increase. And that's just the child's way of trying to medicate whatever issue that they're struggling with. If you take away one coping skill, they find another coping skill. If they have two different coping skills and they can't get to one, they're going to use the other one. So it's very important that we diagnose these children and that if they have these other underlying issues, that those get treated right along with the substance use.
Is that common? Are most of the programs like that?
There are some very good programs that I referred teenagers to that are dual, what we call dual diagnosis. They treat not only the substance use, but they treat the underlying psychological issues. And those are dual diagnosis programs. And there are some really very good, outstanding programs around the country. I think many programs recognize that if a child comes to them, while their primary emphasis might be substance abuse, that oftentimes there's an underlying issue that needs to be treated as well.
How many of these programs, and maybe it's part, you know, step in the process, but how many of these programs also include the parents and like the family dynamic?
I would say the programs that I'm familiar with, the ones that are very good in what they do, they all have a parent education component to them. They all involve the parent in terms of the treatment process. Many of them have programs where parents can visit the treatment center and they do like in-service training for the children. When I was at Menninger Clinic, we would invite the parents to come in and they would spend an entire day and they would go through meeting the staff and getting an education and learning about these different issues. And I think many of the really good quality treatment programs do the same thing. They involve the parent. At Menninger Clinic, we had a social worker assigned to every patient, and the social worker's primary responsibility was to keep in touch with the parent, keep them advised as to what's going on, answer any questions, and involve them in the process. So many of these programs, which are very good programs, have a parent education component, and will also have a staff member assigned to work with the parent throughout the treatment process, and certainly when it gets to the discharge plan, involve the parent in the child's discharge planning as well. That's very important. Parents need to feel as if they're not being isolated during this treatment process. They need to feel as if they're a part of the treatment team and that they're involved in the treatment process, because that child is eventually going to be discharged back home.
Well, yeah, and that's why I brought that up, is because, as I say, you know, I believe that conscious communication with families and, you know, respecting each other emotionally, everybody's needs matter. But if you don't have the communication skills, like you said, it would be nice for you to, instead of punishing or going into, you know, fear-based reactions of consequences for your child, to have that conversation. Yeah. From the work that I see, so many people like don't know how to have those conversations without, you know, blame and shame. And so I would hope that, you know, that the success of the program relies on the family to be able to communicate, and for the child to be able to share without fear or shame or blame and all of that.
And that's a big part of the treatment process, is to do a lot of the family work, because it's not just the child that's affected by the substance use. It's the entire family that's affected. And I think we often lose sight of that, Susan, because we put so much emphasis on the child. That becomes a focus of our attention. And we lose sight of the fact that the family itself often needs treatment. The other thing I say is that every parent can learn listening skills.
Oh, hallelujah!
we're really good, Susan, at listening to each other's words when we talk. So when we're talking to our children, we're very good at hearing the words that they say. We're not so good at hearing the feelings behind the words, and that's a skill that every parent can practice and every parent can learn, so that when we're talking to our children and when we're talking to each other, we're picking up not just the words that they're saying, we're picking up and reflecting back the feelings that that child is trying to communicate, so that we can either hear it correctly or give the child an opportunity to tell us what they really are feeling. And that's a skill that takes work. You know, it takes time, but it's a skill every parent can practice and every parent can learn. And when they become better at doing that, the child is very likely to feel as if there's a real bond of trust between them and their parent, that their parent really does understand not just what they're saying, but what they're feeling.
Yeah. Amen. Hallelujah. All those things. Not enough of that. We need so much more of that in families. Yeah. We're going to take one last quick break. You're listening to the Awakened Parent Project. We'll be right back.
One day, I arrived early to meet a friend for lunch. One of the wait staff welcomed me with a beautiful smile. It was everyday magic. We experience this kind of thing all the time, but it was magical because the smile made me feel happy and content. The Sanskrit word for smile is smitam. It means fully blossomed, fully bloomed and expanded, like an empty field suddenly full of spring flowers. In the same way, a bright smile given freely changes everything. It can warm the heart. It can reassure or inspire or uplift. It can bring joy or lift a burden. Try it for yourself. Smitam, a smile, and discover a little everyday magic. Join me, Sarah Main, on Damayanti, the show for your soul, where we discover everyday uplifting magic together. And check out my website, damayanti.store.
Consider follow through in five stages. First, the vision. Describe the goal and strategy. Second, feasibility. Find out if there are constraints. Third, planning. Lay out a plan and a timetable with target dates. Fourth, action. Do the steps required to get to the finish line. And fifth, completion. Tie up any loose ends. Most people are more comfortable with either planning or doing. Strong planners may hyper-focus on planning and never get to the action. Impatient doers jump straight into action, but can get derailed if they didn't plan for contingencies. Realizing your tendencies, you can determine where your follow-through falls short. Learn the strategies that will keep you on track in my podcast, ADHD Self-Mastery, Customized Strategies for Your Unique Brain.
Learn how to lead a happier life on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back. Today we are talking with Richard Capriola. He is the author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. You can get his book on Amazon. You can also go to his website, which is helptheaddictedchild.com, and get this book. I have it on my Kindle. You can also get, as Richard said, it comes in a hard copy. I think any parent with middle school to high school age children, as I've said, should get this. It's like a Bible for substance abuse. He lists everything. It's an easy read. You're very conversational. It's very informational. Like you said, parents are busy, so you wanted to make it easy for them to have access to this information. And it really, really is super informative. And I think what you do too is you, and this is going to be one of my last questions, is you try to help the parent feel like it's not their fault. You know, like, what did I do? I must have done something wrong. How did my child, you know, and that it really is a dynamic. And so if you suspect your child is using a substance and you're like, oh, I found a joint in their backpack, or, you know, I found a beer can in the trunk of the car or whatever, what's the first thing they should do?
The first thing they should do is have a conversation with their child. Sit down with the child and talk about, you know, what you've observed, what you've seen, whether it's, you know, physical evidence or behavior changes. Don't threaten the child. Don't argue with the child. Don't ground the child, but just very calmly have a conversation, express either what you've seen or the behaviors that you've observed, express that you're concerned, and invite the child to help you understand what you're seeing and why you're seeing it. Now the child may cooperate and give you some information, or they may shut down and get angry. But regardless of how that goes, as a parent, if you're still concerned, you need to move to the next step and get the assessments done from the professionals so that you can either rule in or rule out whether or not there's an issue, whether or not there's an underlying psychological reason going on. And if needed, get some advice on what the next step should be and what kind of treatment would be most helpful.
So with that in mind, with what you just said, where would I even go to, like, what's my first step in getting the assessment? Like, do I find, like, do you know what I mean? If it happened to me today, I wouldn't know who the first person I'm supposed to reach out to is.
I would say that you have several options. First of all, certainly talk to your school counselor. or talk to the school social worker. You know, these schools pay social workers and psychologists and counselors to be there for you as a parent and for your child. So I would begin by having a conversation with the school counselor or the school social worker. Many of them can do a very preliminary assessment for you, and from that assessment can give you advice as to whether or not you need to move on and say, see a psychologist or a neuropsychologist to get a little bit deeper assessment of what's going on. They can also advise you of other people in the community, give you referrals on psychologists and neuropsychologists, addictions counselors that you can follow up on if they think that's advisable. Another source would be your community mental health association. They might be able to provide a good resource and referrals for you. They're also a good source for support. A lot of these mental health associations have parent support groups, and I would recommend that every parent who is going through this build a support system around yourself. It's not just your child that's going to need support and help. You're going to need it as well as a parent. So build yourself a support system. Maybe it's another family member. Maybe it's a good friend. Maybe it's a church community. Maybe it's a support group community. But build a support system around yourself, because this is going to be a journey. This is not going to be something that's going to be over quickly. This is going to be a journey that you and your child are going to go on. So, you know, take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and get a support system around yourself.
One last thing that comes up as you say all of that is, do you think a lot of parents avoid that and go the punishment route because of the stigma associated with it? They don't want anybody in the community to know that their child has a substance abuse problem. They, you know, we aren't those kinds of people, and this doesn't happen here in our family. And so we're just going to punish you, or we're just going to, you know, tighten down the reins. And that just, so I think stigma probably prevents a lot of families from pursuing what's like real treatment.
I think you're right. Unfortunately, there is a stigma with addiction that we don't see with other disorders like mental health disorders or even medical disorders. With addiction, it carries a very negative connotation, a stigma. It's not recognized as a disease, which it really is. And I think many parents feel ashamed. They don't think it can happen to them. They don't think it can happen in their community. And that causes them to feel isolated and afraid and have to deal with all of these emotions by themselves. And that's unfortunate, because believe me, this can happen to any family. This can happen in any community. I often say that there is no child that is totally protected. There are protective environments, but there is no child who's totally protected. It doesn't matter where you live. It doesn't matter what your level of income. It doesn't matter what church you go to. It doesn't matter what school you send your child to. This can happen to any child. I have treated children who have come from extremely wealthy families and families that sent their children to some of the most elite schools in the country. So this can happen to any child. And parents need to just not be paranoid about this. I wrote this book so that they would feel less paranoid, less afraid, and more confident. I would hope that if they read my book, they will walk away thinking, okay, I've got this. I hope it never happens, but I feel better now. I feel like I can handle this if I have to.
And that's exactly what it does. I mean, it's such a great resource, because you don't feel, you feel informed and not like I said, not blindsided or caught off guard or guilty. Because you lay it out very, very clearly. And especially, we didn't really get into it, but you kind of touched on it, but the brain science of it all, which, you know, like you said, their brains are still developing. They're not fully developed until like around 25 or so, but how, you know, teenage brains are so much more influenced by these chemicals. And again, We're coming up on the end here. I cannot recommend this book enough. It's such a wonderful resource. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and to share your examples and your excellent questions. I just feel as if they helped us provide what will be a more informative discussion and hopefully a helpful discussion.
Thank you.
So thank you so much, Susan.
Again, his website is helptheaddictedchild.com. If you'd like to learn more about my signature course, the Ultimate Parent Success Course, please visit my website at susandolce.com, and you can sign up there for a free 30-minute consultation. Remember, conscious parenting isn't perfect parenting. No such thing exists. But perhaps one step to more conscious parenting is allowing your children to be your awakening. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for being a part of the Awakened Parent Project. My goal with this show is to help us all become more compassionate and engaged parents by diving into the many techniques and ideologies of the conscious parenting community. This is a safe space to embark on a practical and spiritual journey of self-exploration and expand our ideas about conscious parenting. Got thoughts, questions, ideas? I want to hear from you. Reach out to me if there's a topic you'd like to hear covered on the show, or to share your conscious parenting story by visiting susandolce.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.